the practical way life works most of the time. You can find exceptions to most any rule, and probably that's the case in Proverbs as well. But it sets down a particular set of parameters of how life works. It's kind of like the standard operating procedure guide for life and the wisdom in it. The subtitle of the series that we have been using is this, Unlocking the Treasures of Proverbs. That's the reason we used a graphic of a bank vault as the background, because this is a collection of wise sayings and some narratives, not narratives, but I should say of discourses on various subjects, and they're compiled into a whole, which is a vast treasure trove of scriptural wisdom and biblical truth. And we want to just kind of spin the dial and find the right combination and open the vault and reach into it tonight and pick out a few themes that are before us, and so that we can understand God's wisdom. Tonight, as we look at the last section, beginning verse 20, through the end of this chapter, there's two more themes that we're going to pick out, which complete, I should say, the list of themes, the list of subjects that are found in this collection of sayings that Solomon has put together. And they revolve around these two subjects. First of all is just wisdom, or living wisely. And secondly is honor, and that is in a proper sense of giving honor to somebody that is living a wise and godly life. Honor that we should give and honor that we should receive, and those two themes kind of complement each other. Tonight we're going to look at it in this point of view. We're going to talk about being good, that's the why sort of thing, and then talk about looking good, that's the honor, if you will. So being good and looking good. And I don't mean that looking good in the sense of vanity or to being dishonest, but if our lives are of such a caliber that they are displaying the virtues of Christ, then we will look good to people, not in a fleshly sense, but in a way that's going to attract them to our God. So it's a kind of that outward expression, if you will. So we're going to just jump in and into this section and look at the first one, which is being good. And we see, first of all, that being good is seen in two distinct aspects. First of all, being good is seen in the lessons learned. Lessons learned, and there are three of them in verse 20, 21, and then in 22. Lessons learned. Verse 20, if you will. A wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish man despises his mother. We call this one lessons learned from those before us. And you're going to find that family is a sub-theme that repeats itself in these next few verses. But first of all, lessons learned from those before us here in verse 20. We see, first of all, he says this, that a wise son makes a father glad. That's kind of one of those, well, that is so obvious, why do we even have to restate it? But it is so true. If you have children that grow up and are living a wise life, a life that's marked by wisdom, and are following the things of God, that certainly brings joy to the heart of any parent. I really am convinced that the sum total of the goal of a parent, and this parent is one as well, really is not necessarily economic or social status or even their own happiness, if you will, although we want our children to be happy. There's nothing wrong with them having the ability to make a decent living and so forth. But ultimately, above it all, is to live a life that honors our God. If our children grow up and they love the Lord and they follow God all their days, what better joy could you have that comes to the heart? And we are living lives, whether our parents are still with us or not, we are living lives that reflect on them. And hopefully, in some sense, we are living in wisdom that brings gladness to a father. He says, but a foolish man, he gives the opposite, is one of those contrasts, if you will, which is a common expression in Proverbs. But a foolish man despises his mother. Well, I would think we would say most people don't set out to despise your mother. That would not make a good Mother's Day theme, by any way. That wouldn't be a good verse to preach on. I still get grief that I preached on Jezebel one Mother's Day, and I'm never going to hear the end of that one. But this one definitely doesn't fit, you know. This is how to despise your mother. Well, you just live foolishly. But the result is that, is it not? If you choose to live your life in a way that is focused on self and damaging to others and hurtful to others and with a life filled with broken relationships and all the debris of poor choices and a sinful lifestyle, really you're despising the teaching if you had a mother that was seeking to teach you in the proper way. You see, walking wisdom brings joy and peace in the home. And we need to learn lessons from those who are before us. Can I just clue you in on something? This is slightly off the subject, maybe not, but maybe slightly. If you want to know yourself better, you need to be a good student of your parents. If you want to know your spouse better, you be a good student of his or her parents. You really want to know what someone is like? We really never get over our upbringing. Now, we can improve and grow, but there is the parameters of life that are set by our parents are indelibly marked in who we are. You want to know what you're really like? You can learn a lot by observing your parents. You want to know what your spouse is like? You want to know him or her better? Understand all you can about their dynamics. You can learn a lot, whether that relationship was loving and nurturing or that relationship was tumultuous or there was separation or there was estrangement. All of those are dynamics that factor into the person that you are. And you would do well to be a student of it. So lessons learned. If we want to be a person that is good on the inside, then first of all, the lessons learned from those before us need to be in the forefront. Now, there's a particular key that tells us how we can do that. And I'm going to tell you what that key is, but I'll tell you in just a little bit, okay? Just kind of push the pause button on that. Look at the second thing learned. Lessons learned from those above us. Look at verse 21. Folly is joy to him who is destitute of discernment, but a man of understanding walks uprightly. I want to look at the second half first, then we'll go back and catch that very provocative statement in the first part of that verse. But that's where we get the idea of those above us, those that are our role models, and ultimately God is the ultimate role model and His Word is the ultimate guidebook for life. But a man of understanding walks uprightly, walks in accordance with these lessons learned, with these principles of life. A man who walks uprightly is a man who has decided, or a woman who has decided, that I am going to obey God. That is the basic understanding of life, to walk in obedience to God. Now, the first part of the verse, again, it's a contrast, and we're looking at it in reverse fashion. But folly is joy. Foolishness is joy. Foolishness is fun. Foolishness is a one big party. To whom? To this person who is destitute of discernment. Have you ever wondered why people that are in a destructive pattern of life run with such energy and such vigor and such enthusiasm headlong into that life? Here's the reason. A person that's caught up in folly, to him it appears to be, and they've swallowed the hook, line, and sinker of the bait of our enemy, in a sense of, it looks so appealing. It looks like this is the path to happiness. This is the path to joy. I found a quote by E.D. Rodmacher who says, "The compounding problem of folly is that it feeds upon itself. Where there is folly, there will be delighted fools. Where there is folly, there is also an understanding man who is making tracks in the other direction." So the choice is there for us all. We have higher standards set before us by the role models that God has given us, and the ultimate role model is God Himself. And that should be the lessons that we are taking in, and the lessons we're learning, and the path that we are following, rather than going into this lifestyle which appears so fun and so joyous and so happy. You know, it's no wonder that you see a sign on the bar that says at a certain time, "Happy Hour." You know, this is the way. This is the path to happiness. Well, I would beg to differ that is the path to happiness. The path to happiness and joy is following obediently after God's path and being with God's people and walking in the example of those that are godly examples before us. That's really the happy lifestyle. Well, then we have lessons learned from those around us in verse 22. Lessons learned. There are lessons learned from those around us. Look at verse 22. "Without counsel, plans go awry, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established." It's a great verse. It's a good verse to commit to memory. He's saying this. Now, we should pack around us people who can give us godly advice. People that can point us in the right direction, that can help us make good decisions in life. Now, even with the best of human advisors, that does not guarantee that every decision we're going to make is going to meet with success. But here is a guarantee. If you do not surround yourself with the right kind of advisors, you will guarantee the opposite of success, because that's what he says. Without counsel, what's going to happen? Plans are going to go awry. They're going to, really, that means to leave the road, run in the ditch, wreck, be crashed along the course of life. They're going to go awry. They're going to go off the path without counsel. We should surround ourselves with godly counsel. There's one good reason why we need godly counsel. Because most of us do not really see ourselves as we really are. Let me repeat that because I think it's important. Most of us, let me change that. Can we erase that from the tape? All of us fail to see ourselves as we really are. That's why we need other people around us to tell us when we're getting off the path. That's the reason Jesus said, you know, you can spot a speck in someone else's eye. You know, from a long way off, I can see their fault, I can see their failings. But you know, and he uses this extreme language and the irony of it, but you're missing that you've got this great big plank in your own eye. We're not very good at self-reflection. We're not very good at self-analysis. That's why we need people around us that love us enough to tell us the truth, and why we need people around us that love God enough to tell us His truth. I just want to ask you a very simple question, but you can't answer this out loud in this kind of a group, but who are the people in your life? Who are the people in your life that you access for godly counsel when you're making a decision? And let me just say it this way. The bigger the decision, the more important it is to get wise counsel in life. All of us probably have lived out the words of the first part of verse 22. You ever just run into something without really asking anybody or thinking about it or getting some counsel, and suddenly that great-looking plan, and you run in the ditch of life? So learn from those that are around us. So being good is seen, first of all, in the lessons learned, that we're living in accordance with the lessons learned from those who are before us, our parents and our godly examples. From those who are before us, the godly examples in life, ultimately that's God Himself. And lessons learned from those who are around us, that's the counselors, our peers, that should be helping to steer our life in a right direction. There is a key in this passage that tells us that's what we should do. There's a key in this passage that tells us how to do that. And I'm going to tell you what that key is, but I'm going to tell you in just a little bit, okay? Could you just wait? If you can just hang on, we're going to come back to that. The second aspect of being good is seen not only in lessons learned, but in lessons lived out, if you will. Lessons lived. Excuse me. In lessons lived. And he goes back to a couple of very familiar themes in the book of Proverbs, one that you see often. And interestingly, we sometimes see these themes that repeat themselves, and we say, why is he saying the same thing again, only slightly different? One of the reasons is so that we would notice the themes that are repeated often, because those are the themes that we really need to work on. The first one is the proper use of speech in our language. Lessons lived. Lessons lived are seen by the proper use of speech, using proper speech. Look at verse 23. A man has joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. How good it is. The proper use of speech. And here he's talking about the positive and right words spoken at the right time to the right person, how they can bring great healing to life, and how they can encourage us in life. And we need to be people that are living out this lesson learned, that what we say should be used to build people up and encourage people and to strengthen them and to bring healing and reconciliation, rather than what is so easy to come out of our mouths, that which tears down and that which divides and that which discourages. Sometimes, notice the little phrase there in the end of verse 23, a word spoken in due season. It's talking about the right time. I want to just kind of enlarge that just enough to add this little idea. Not only should we watch when we say and what we say, but we who communicate as much by our tone and by our facial expression and our body language as we do by just the words and our vocabulary that's coming out of our mouths, we should also be very aware of not only what we say, but the very tone in which we say it. I mean, you can say very loving words, but say them in a tone that still communicate, I really am dissatisfied with you, and I really don't want to get close to you, and I really, you know, would like to keep you like at least that distance away from me, just by our very tone. So when it talks about words that are fitly spoken or words that are spoken in due season, we need to be with everything that we can to be able to communicate in such a way that builds people up. Builds people up. There was a lady in a church that we were in prior to being at Bible Center, and she was a hypochondriac, is what she was, okay? She had a new disease, new sickness every week. And I learned very early that as a pastor, you wouldn't say, hello, Mrs., you know, her name, and say, how are you feeling today, or how are you doing? Because she would give you the latest litany of everything that hurt, and I've got to go to the doctor, and the report from the doctor, and the most recent test. Now, I don't deny the fact that she probably had some health issues, and I'm not trying to make light of that, but she was so focused on everything that was wrong with her, she really couldn't see that there was still some blessing in God. She was still breathing, she was still on her feet, still getting out, she still had some ability to serve. So I made up my mind that I was going to stop asking the how are you question, because first of all, I didn't have enough time to hear the answer every week. So I decided in my mind, I'm going to find something positive to say to this lady every week when she comes. And sometimes it was a stretch. I think I told the truth, but, you know, just, it's so good. You must be feeling better because you made it to church today. You're looking good. The fact that you're here brings a smile to my face. I'm glad to see you. Just, you know, I just tried everything I could. I don't think I cured her of hypochondria. Is that a word? Hypochondriac? Whatever she was, I didn't heal her of that. But you know what? I think God in some way used my words to encourage her and at least start to help her focus on the blessing of God rather than the burdens of life. So watch what we say, even the questions we ask, and find words that encourage and build people up. Look, if you will, at verse 24. It's a great verse. The way of life winds upward for the wise, that he may turn away from hell below. Here we see by making progress in life, by using proper speech and by making progress in life. You see, every life is going in a particular direction. Your life is going in a particular direction. There are times that it's going and maybe in a different direction than it is now, but there's a particular direction of your life. And he's saying, if you walk in wisdom and you live for the wise and this way of life, he says it winds upward. Isn't that a great thing? It's just like a winding trail up a mountain. We're getting ever higher, ever ascending. And that's a metaphor, a picture, an illustration of that God wants us to becoming more and more, more and more like he wants us to be. What a great picture. I want to be on the upward winding road. You know, I want to be on that trek of life rather than, and it's a very provocative way of saying, that he may turn away from hell below. The opposite is a downward spiral. And that doesn't mean if we get off the path that instantly God condemns us or anything, but that's a very powerful way of saying either we're getting more like God and getting closer to him, or we're going in a way that's leading us away from a lifestyle and a life and a heart that reflects him. So he's basically saying we need to be making progress in life. So being good, this character issue, if you will, is first of all seen in lessons learned from those before us, above us, and around us. It's seen in lessons lived, how we talk, and the general progress in life. And there's a key in this passage, that's what to do, but there's a key in this passage that tells us how to do it. And I'm going to tell you what it is in just a little bit. We want to next look at verses 25 and following, and we're going to see the second character quality, which is honor, and we're going to call this looking good. Looking good is seen in the quality of three things. Looking good is seen in the quality of three things. First of all, in the quality of our house. Verses 25 and 27, there is an error on your outline, and that is my fault. Verse 26 actually goes with point B rather than point A. So we're going to look at verses 25, 27, and 26. We'll look at in just a moment. Verse 25, "The Lord will destroy the house of the proud, but He will establish the boundary of the widow." He uses language to help us with understanding what is, first of all, going to be damaging to your household. And he says it's very simple. It's one simple word called pride. God is just saying and warning us that if we just give in to our human fleshly pride, it is going to damage our household. It's going to damage our relationships. It's going to damage everything we touch and taint everything that we're involved in. Human pride. And let's also say this, there is not one of us that do not struggle with pride. It is the absolute default setting on fallen humanity, and on this side of being glorified and being made fully like Christ, we're going to struggle with pride. So put that in the crosshairs of your attention as you understand that pride is something we struggle with. And he's saying, if we give into our pride, if we just live for ourselves, and if our life is all about making ourselves important, then he said, that is going to destroy your house. But he said, but when it comes to the righteous, he's going to establish the boundary of the widow. In their culture, a widow was the most vulnerable person, the most defenseless person in society. If a woman was left as a widow without a husband or male children to support her, she was in a bad way economically and socially. It was just being cut off from anything and everything. But he said, God stands up and he says he's going to establish the boundary. He's going to make sure there's inheritance for her, that God is going to speak up and God is going to defend and God is going to look out for even the most defenseless of those that walk in accordance with him. Not only is it seen in the quality of her house, it's seen in the quality... I'm sorry, verse 27. It goes with this one as well. Verse 27, here's another one on the house. "He who is greedy for gain troubles his own house, but he who hates bribes will live." By the way, greed and pride are pretty closely linked in the human heart. But greed just means I want to get all the stuff I can get. Pride means I want to get all the attention and all the, you know, all the self-gathering of about myself of life. It's a pride. Here he talks about greed. If you want to trouble your house, if you want to cause damage to your household, you want to damage your relationships, be a greedy for gain person. And it's kind of self-feeding as well, just like what we saw earlier. If we get into a greedy cycle, it can become so overwhelming that the desire for stuff and whatever the stuff is becomes so overwhelming that even we sacrifice our children, we sacrifice our spouse, or we sacrifice our extended family, or we even sacrifice our relationship with the people of God. We need to watch greed. Over in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul wrote this. He said, if you really want to have gain rather than greed, he said, godliness with contentment is great gain. Focus on living a life of godliness and being content in whatever God gave you. And God didn't give us all the same amount of stuff. Because some of us don't have garages big enough to hold all the stuff that someone else has, you know? So we'd all have different amounts of stuff. But be content with whatever He gave you, little or a lot. Be content. You focus on that, and then that is great profit, great gain. He says, but he who hates bribes will live. He who isn't about money, who would not even be tempted or even be the least bit attracted to taking a bribe to do something illegal or unethical, that kind of person, that money doesn't affect them. What's he say there? That's the person who's going to live, who's going to prosper in life. So secondly, he goes to heart. And that's in verses 26 and then 28 to 20 and 29. 26, he talks about heart. The quality of this honor that we receive is seen in our house. It's seen in our heart. And there's a key that's going to unlock how to do all this. And I'm going to tell you what that key is in just a little bit. All right, are you ready? First of all, we're going to look at the heart. Verse 26. The thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord, but the words of the pure are pleasant. See, there's no such thing as a private thought. God hears it all. And we need to understand that God is pleased or displeased not only with the quality and of our speech and our outward expression, But God is either pleased or displeased with the quality of our thought life. Right after Julie and I got married, I got a second job because we were struggling a bit. And I got a second job working mainly nights at a gas station along the interstate. And so you'd spend all night in this little box behind bulletproof glass. And if you want someone wanted to pay, you'd shove this little door out, and they'd either drop their credit card or their cash in, and you'd pull the door in. So, you know, you were in this was kind of the scene it was. And they had this microphone bigger than this one, but you had to get about this close to the microphone to be heard by the guy on the other side or the lady on the other side of the bulletproof glass. And if you pulled your head back about this far, they couldn't hear anything you said. So I remember my boss who was training me, you know, he'd slide the little drawer out, and someone would put their money in, and he'd slide it back out, and he'd say, "Thank you very much, you moron. Have a nice day." Isn't that person an idiot? I just, like, you know, I hopefully didn't pick up that quality of life. But outwardly, you know, glad you're here, all this. But then when the bulletproof glass was shielding his voice, it was a whole nother thought process that he gave words to. Now, you and I probably aren't going to do that, I trust, but God sees beyond the glass. God hears the privacy of our thoughts. And he says the thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord. He reserves the right to eavesdrop on our very thoughts. It speaks of heart. Look at verse 28. The heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours forth evil. He uses the word heart there, and he's speaking of that we should stop and ponder before we speak. We should be slow to speak and slow to wrath and all those things that we're told over the New Testament. We need to be careful of what our first reaction is, because oftentimes our first reaction is not the best reaction. We live in a world of instant communication. You know, it used to be if you wanted to say something, you'd sit down, get out a piece of paper, and sit out and write out a nice long letter and, you know, stick it in an envelope and address it, put a stamp on it, seal it, take it to the mailbox. That was about 10 different opportunities that you could cool down, and probably some of us have written some of those letters that never got mailed. Now we live in a day of, they said what, they did what, email, boom, it's right there at them. And we've just singed their eyebrows off their computer screen as they read the email. Because it's so instantaneous. It's just, you know, and in the email world, it has now come of exchange of emails that are antagonistic to each other. It's called starting a flame war, or just flaming a person, just like, you know, fire at them. Well, we of all people need to be people that in our hearts that we stop and ponder our words. And I talk to you as one who pleads guilty to all of the above. But you know what? He says, in our hearts, we need to stop and ponder and study how to answer rather than just being a person that just spews forth the first thing that comes out. 29. The Lord is far from the wicked, but he hears the prayer of the righteous. Here should be the heart of a follower of God. Our heart should be one that just talks to God in prayer. You got a concern? Lord, help me with that. I got a decision? Lord, help me to make a right decision. God, you identify a blessing. Thank you for the blessing of that person or that situation. There should be a heart that is constantly in tune with God. We probably all have a way to go with that. Someone told me once years ago, said, if you ever want to make people feel guilty, just one of the things you want to preach on is prayer, because none of us feel like we've arrived. So that is true. But nonetheless, that should be what really our heart should be consumed with, is a conversation with God. Well, three more verses, and then, I promised to tell you the key of how to do this, right? And I'm going to tell you what it is in just a little bit. This is the what, I'll tell you the how in just a little bit. Verse 30. And these all have to do, 30, 31, 32, have to do with positive thinking, positive attitude, positive of feelings of just those sort of things, of just having a good frame of mind, the powerful effect it can have. The light of the eyes rejoices the heart. And a good report makes the bones healthy. There is a connection between mind and body, and even science has recognized that. That doesn't mean that just positive thinking can do anything. But we should, particularly as we focus on God's Word and God's person, if that's the quality and the content of our thinking, it will have a positive impact upon even our physical health and our demeanor and our, as he says there, bones healthy and a rejoicing heart. Verse 31, the ear that hears the reproof of life will abide among the wise. That we are willing to receive rebuke from others. If we're able to hear rebuke and make positive change in life, that is a picture of psychological health, is one way we would say it. That we are a mature person. That we can hear the areas that are wrong. And rather than getting defensive and angry, that we can take that and process that and with God's help turn that into something positive in life. Verse 32. He who disdains instruction despises his own soul, but he who heeds reproof gets understanding. When he talks about soul, he's talking about down in the core of who we are. And he's saying if you just don't want to hear anyone giving you positive instruction, he says that's going to tear you up from the inside out. It's going to be destructive to your soul. So health here has to do more than physical health. It has to do with the health of our soul and our spirit and the totality of who we are. So the honor part is seen in the looking good, and it's seen in the quality of our house, our heart, our health. Being good is seen in the lessons learned and the lessons lived. That's the what. And there's a key that unlocks it all. And I believe I promised that I was going to tell you what it is. And it's the last verse of the chapter. Verse 33. The fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. Here's the key. Then we want to illustrate that, and then we'll sum it with the concluding statement. The key, being good and looking good, all begins with respect, fear of God, and humility, knowing our place before God. All right? It all starts with that. If we can be people who honor God for who He is and keep Him in the proper place of praise and worship and adoration and respect and, yes, God born in a right sense, fear of God. And if we correspondingly can be humble before God and thereby being humble before our fellow believers, that's the key that unlocks the being good and the looking good. So how does that take place? Those of you that were in the singles class this morning, I already thanked them because they helped me with my conclusion this morning because we kind of studied this together. And it's also going to be a little bit of a preview. We're going to, the 4 weeks between Thanksgiving, 4 Wednesday nights between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we're going to do what we're going to call Bible Institute Overtime. We're going to do, it's kind of like a best of 3 different series we've taught previously. I'm just going to pick 4 sessions the teachers are and give you a chance. Y'all complain, well, I'd really like to go to that one, but I only offer it once. So some of you, this is going to help you find godliness with contentment and great gain. All right, this is going to help you out. But I'm going to do one. I'm going to do 4 parts on a series I did a few years ago called Those Who Met God. And there's an interesting series of observations that you can learn from the people in the Bible that had an experience with God. And that's going to take 4 weeks and 40 minutes each, so I'm just going to give you the barest little scratch in the surface here. But you think about Moses in Exodus 33. Remember, that's where God hides him in the cleft of the rock and God passes through? And God tells him, no man can see me and live. You can't experience my glory and live. And in humility and in awe, Moses gets back in that rock and God's glory is revealed to him. And as God revealed His glory, His mission was given to him again. His mission was given. Another one you find in Isaiah chapter 6, in the year the king Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. You know that wonderful passage? After he sees this vision of the glory of God, he makes this statement. He says, woe is me, for I am undone. Woe is me, for I am undone. He got a vision of how magnificent God was, respect and fear, and immediately it drove him to a place of humility where he said, woe is me. Undone literally means to be disassembled. He's basically saying, I am destroyed. I am blown away. I am done for because I've seen the glory of God. In Ezekiel chapter 1, the last verse of Ezekiel 1, Ezekiel has this vision, and it's unlike any other you find in all of Scripture. You know, that's the wheels and the creatures and the platforms and the you know, the rainbows and just all that stuff. And the imagery just puts even the reader in sensory overload of the glory of God. And we come to the very end of that first revelation of God to Ezekiel, and basically it says, I fell on my face. In Revelation chapter 1, verse 17, after you have another throne room scene of God, John says, I fell on my face as dead. You want to know how to have respect? Which unlocks living good and being good? You want to know how to be driven to humility, which results in living good and looking good? We don't have the opportunity to stand by the river Chebar like Ezekiel did and have God just roll back the veil and show himself. We don't have the opportunity to stand with Moses on Mount Sinai and cower in the cleft of the rock as the glory of God in all of its awesomeness passed by. We don't have the privilege, like Isaiah, of being swept into the throne room of God and hear the angels crying, holy, 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 and the pillars of the temple shaking at the impact of it. But you and I have been given two things. One is what we hold in our hand, and the other thing is what helps us process what we hold in our hand, which is our mind. We need to spend time in this book and engage this imagination and this mind and this thought process and all that we can, that we regularly will have significant meetings with the God and see Him as He is, to realize that He is the Creator, the Sustainer, and the Judge of both the living and the dead. As we spend time in His presence, it first of all enlarges our respect and adoration of Him, and we, by default, are driven to a place of humility. And when God has us in a place of respect and God has us in a place of humility, we will never be the same. Moses renewed his mission and led the people for those 40 years. Isaiah received his message to give to the people of his day. Ezekiel was given a ministry to those that lived in exile after he met God. John, in essence, was given the manuscript, as he said, you write down these things and write out the manuscript of history yet to be fulfilled. They were never the same because they met with God. And may God help us to be people that respect God and people that live in humility before God, and that we will never be the same, and that will be reflected in a life that is being good and a life that looks good in a proper sense. Friends, live a wise and honorable life. That's our concluding statement. Live a wise and honorable life. May God give us the grace to do that. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for your truth. Thank you that you tell us what we need to hear, not always what we want to hear. But help us to live in wisdom. Help us to live in a life that reflects your character. Help us, Lord, to start with living in the fear of God. And help us, Lord, to live in humility before you, our God. And Lord, as we do that, we know we won't be the same. We confess to you that we need to change. There's much that needs to be improved and much that needs to be removed from our lives. In all that, we pray that you'd be at work. Help us to be people that live in a way that pleases you and you alone, for we ask in your name.